Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, February 11th, 2017. It's just after 17 UTC as we're recording this, a lot later than we usually do it in the week. And the reason is Yvonne and I kept trying to reschedule a couple times because his whole family is sick. First his wife, then his son. He said that basically he's running a hospital at the moment, and he's overwhelmed as he's taking care of everything and dealing with everything and taking people to the doctor and all that kind of stuff. So hopefully he'll be better soon. But he, after our last attempt, it was clear he wasn't going to be able to make it at all this week. So I sent out an invite to a bunch of the folks who have either co-hosted the show in the past or have expressed interest in doing so, and I actually got three volunteers this time. So we're going to have a little bit different kind of show. We've got four of us talking this week, and we'll go through a few different topics. My son Alex is here too. Being quiet.
Wait.
Be quiet.
Getting my card.
Yes, there you go. So in any case, we are, each of us is responsible for picking one topic. We're going to do four topics this show. The basic order, I'm not sure what order we'll do them in, but the four topics, we're going to talk Donald Trump and the judiciary. We're going to talk Donald Trump and foreign policy. We're going to talk Nevertheless She Persisted, the Elizabeth Warren story, and Vitriol in Dialogue, basically the tone of political conversation as it's been lately. And those are going to be our four segments. In any case, the people that we have today joining me are Ed from Florida/Pennsylvania, Matt from Illinois, and Jen from Washington State. So thank you to all three of you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Okay, now let me let each of you spend a few minutes introducing yourselves just so that folks know who you are. So let's start out with Ed. Ed, introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Ed Haynes. I'm a retired physician, retired in 2000. I got tired of going through computer crashes that year. I spent most of my career in the Army and had some experience in command while in the Army. Currently, after I retired, I decided to do my old passion, which was carpentry, and I've renovated a couple houses, one here in Jacksonville, one in the Poconos, and one in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. I'm about to retire from that, and my current activities mostly are that of training for a triathlon, the first of which I did last June. I'm going to repeat that one and maybe a couple more this year. That keeps me young.
Sounds like it. Okay, Jen.
Holy moly, I'm not sure I can live up to anything even remotely resembling that. I'm Jen. I live in downtown Seattle. I do product and marketing, and I used to work with Sam at his current company, but I left a long time ago. I just work. I don't do triathlons. I spin. I do Pilates. I'm just not that interesting, but I am a flaming liberal, as you all will notice probably momentarily.
Okay, and Matt.
I'm Matt. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I'm an attorney, and I think I'm the only Republican in this town. I've been active in politics for about 15 years now, and that's about it for now.
Okay, very good. Well, that's the four of us. Oh, and I'm Sam. You know me. I'm on the show every week. We will take a break now, and we will jump right in. And I just rolled some dice. You might have heard it. We're going to do the Nevertheless She Persisted topic first. So, Jen, get ready, and then we'll all talk about it. It won't just be Jen talking for 20 minutes. But
well, thank heavens.
we will be back right after this. You're listening to this podcast. Do you like it?
No!
Do you want to support the show?
No!
Well, after you have subscribed to the show, followed us on Facebook, and told all your friends they should be listening to, what else can you do?
I won't subscribe!
You can help fund our Patreon at patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner. Patreon is a way you can throw us a few bucks a month to help out with the expenses of the show. you know, web hosting, equipment, a little bit of advertising to promote the show, and maybe every once in a while some much needed sedatives for Yvonne. At different contribution levels, you can get a mention on the show, a Curmudgeon's Corner postcard, or even a Curmudgeon's Corner mug. Fun stuff.
Not fun.
In any case, the contributions help tell us that you enjoy and appreciate the show.
I really, really hate Curmudgeon's Corner.
Are we worth a buck a month?
No!
$5 a month?
No!
Or if you are nuts about us, maybe even more.
Anywhere near $1 billion.
If we're worth anything to you at all, send it our way at patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner.
Alex hates, really, really hates Curmudgeon's Corner! That's really mean, isn't it? But I hate Curmudgeon's Corner, but I really do!
Okay, we are back. Jen, so start us out. I think most of us listening to the show who follow things know about this incident, but why don't you give the quick background and then the points you want to make, and then we'll chat about it.
Sure. So during the debate on the session's confirmation, Elizabeth Warren attempted to read a letter from Coretta Scott King that she wrote basically pointing out his racism a while back when he was up for federal judge? I can't even remember.
I believe that's correct.
And she was shut down from a little used rule in the Senate for criticizing a fellow senator. And the fallout from this has been far more interesting than the actual incident itself, insofar as Elizabeth Warren actually ended up reading the letter on a Facebook video that received well over 6 million views. It was 6 million views like 24 hours later. And then McConnell said, she was warned, she was given an explanation, nevertheless, she persisted. And that last three words of nevertheless, she persisted has become a really big rallying cry for women, including me, obviously, since I brought it up as a topic. What more info, background info would you like to give, Sam?
No, I think that covers it.
There's one more thing.
Yeah.
And that is that a couple of male senators were able to read that letter.
After she attempted to, right?
After later she attempted to. And they didn't shut them down.
Yeah, which actually seems more interesting than some of the other things. I mean, on the rule itself, as you said, it's rarely invoked. But there, you can point out numerous examples in the past of senators who've come right up to that line, and sometimes they've been told to stop, and sometimes they haven't. It's been very sort of inconsistent. But the fact that they used it on her, then didn't use it on people doing the exact same thing slightly later, seemed a little weird. And one of the things that people have talked about is this an intentional tactic by McConnell and company to actually elevate Warren and make her into something that red state Democrats have to defend to make it harder for them to win themselves? Because the gamble is that while she may be incredibly popular amongst the liberal base, she is not amongst sort of the red state borderline, the Democrats are just barely holding on types. And so while everybody gets all excited about Elizabeth Warren on the liberal side of the fence, this actually could poison certain Democrats in red states. And that's one thing I've heard. And
wow, I haven't heard that one. That sounds a little conspiracy theorist to me.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I've actually heard a lot of people mentioning that as a potential thing that McConnell and company had in mind, that they specifically targeted her. Because obviously, if you're having a discussion about whether a senator is appropriate for a cabinet position, the people who are against that are going to say mean things about that senator, you know, in one way or another. So having
criticize, at least, maybe not say mean things.
Well, yeah. Okay. they're but having a rule that says that you can't disparage a sitting senator kind of runs up against a problem if what you're trying to do is discuss that senator's fitness for a new position.
Right. It feels like a gag rule.
So I
think that's what it is.
So okay.
Isn't it intended as a gag rule, basically?
I think, well, the intention of the rule, going back however many hundreds of years it's been in place, is to make sure that discussion in the Senate stays civil and does not become personal. That's what the reason for the rule's existence is. But what the reason is in this particular case, I mean, I think, you know, part of the reason people are talking about that conspiracy theory is because it should have been extremely obvious to McConnell or anyone else that doing this would result in much more attention than not doing it. Like, if they had just let her give her speech, nobody would have even noticed.
Oh, yeah. Now, what's interesting, though, is that I've heard a different theory. I've heard that it is fairly clear to everyone in the Senate that Elizabeth Warren is already campaigning for 2020. Yeah. In which case, I'm like, please, God, yes. But that she's been grandstanding a lot. And this was about it for them. And so this was the first time they've been able to invoke a gag rule against her. Now, what's interesting, though, is that it feels super ham-fisted. I mean, even the words that McConnell used the next day, saying she was warned, she was given an explanation, nevertheless, she persisted. I've had friends call that out as domestic abuser language. Which I think that's taking it a little bit far, and it's a little bit inflammatory, but it struck a chord. And so I don't know that I realize this is my total liberal bubble and liberal bias saying it, but I'm like, is that gang really smart enough to try to piss off red state Democrats? I mean,
they say look for old men in jobs populated by younger people, and Mitch McConnell has been around for a long time.
Yeah, so Matt, with as you mentioned earlier, you said you felt like you're the only Republican in Chicago. You quite possibly are the only Republican on this panel as well. What are your thoughts on this whole incident and how it played out?
My initial reaction was similar to Jen's. I thought it was a sloppy move that was short-sighted and ultimately going to bite Republicans in the butt later down the line. And now that you mention it, now that you've brought up the possible idea that Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans are trying to bring Elizabeth Warren's celebrity to a point where it boils over or fizzles out, or at the same time could hold purple state Democrats to put them in a position to where they have to defend her and maybe jeopardize their seats, I'm thinking, based on what I know about Mitch McConnell, that's not outside the realm of possibility. He is a crafty man. He's been around for a long time. He knows how to play the game, so to speak.
So what do you think the and this is for all of you, what do you think the balance here is? I mean, you know, first of all, you know, I guess everybody assumes Warren will run in 2020, and that really the only reason she didn't in 2016 was sort of clearing the field for Hillary Clinton. But do you think in the end this is it going to stick in any way? Will anybody even remember this in a few months? Is it going to help the Democrats more by sort of rallying people around and, oh, this is so unjust? Or is the McConnell-type strategy actually likely? I mean, I'll give you my thoughts, is that probably it's a net zero, because I think you definitely... And this will tie into our vitriol discussion lately, because I think how you respond to this really does have to do with what side of the aisle you're on and what and the polarization that we have anyway. So, yes, you're going to have a lot of people on the liberal side rallying around this and saying, look at what they're doing. They're trying to shut her down. This is so unfair. She's great. But you're going to have a lot of people on the other side who are just more convinced by this that, you know, here's someone who's just posturing and they're they're trying to make unfair accusations of racism using Coretta Scott King, etc. And I think you'll end up with a wash.
I disagree. So first, Warren is already using "Nevertheless, She Persisted" for her 2018 Senate campaign.
Of course.
So you can buy a T-shirt, or at least donate and get a T-shirt. I mean, I think this is the first time this is something that I'm passionate about, a slogan, a phrase that I'm truly passionate about, to the extent that I actually bought notebooks for all of the women in my office. I work for a startup, so there's about seven of us, or eight of us total with HR, and I bought everybody notebooks that said, "Nevertheless, she persisted." Because to me, saying "Nevertheless, she persisted" is, that is something that, as a woman who has risen up the ranks in leadership and who has watched, and I mean, the last time I was on the show, I talked about freaky man children in the Bay Area. So it's one of those, "Nevertheless, she persisted" is the only way that successful women become successful. We're told to shut up. We're given explanations. Without persisting, we don't have anything. So it more than resonates. It's not just political resonance. It's life.
And I have seen what you just said from many, many women that I have on my Facebook feed saying exactly the same thing, that this represents their daily experience in life.
Yes.
And that's why it's especially powerful to them.
Yeah, my dad actually posted a really cool picture that somebody had posted on Instagram that was somebody who had written quotes that women hear all the time, you know, "get thinner" or "shut up" or whatever, you know, and all over a wall.
Just for people who want to look for that, the artist is Courtney Privett, who posted that picture that Jen is talking about.
Yeah. And it says, "Nevertheless, she persisted." And I have felt, I mean, I live in a liberal city. I work with a lot of really amazing guys, but it doesn't mean that I don't hear or see perceived slights every day, or something, or it's uphill, or I'm the only woman on almost every conference call I'm on at work. Despite having a lot of women in the office, they just tend to be more junior. So it's "Nevertheless, she persisted."
Anybody else have additional thoughts on this?
Well, you commented, excuse me, early on about the similarity to that and spousal abuse situations. And I'll have to say that it invariably, in those spousal abuse cases that I treated as a physician, part of the man's defense of what he had done was that I warned her and I told her and she just wouldn't listen. So it really is very reminiscent of that. And it's kind of disturbing, in all honesty, when you add to that that it was very clearly, it was only geared towards the female senator. There were at least three men who read that entire letter or major excerpts of it, none of whom were interrupted or squashed. And it was just as defamatory towards Senator Sessions as it was when it came from her mouth. It's just kind of another element of the disturbing things that are going on, not only for women, but for kind of all minorities and everything in the past few years in our nation.
So, a bigger picture.
Sorry, go ahead, Matt. I was just going to ask for your opinion, and you were jumping in anyway, so I apologize for stepping on you. Go ahead.
The time felt right. I think on a bigger picture scale, the event itself will probably fizzle out. I've noticed in the past few election cycles, and granted, I haven't been around for that many, but I've noticed that people respond better to things that are positive emotion, that outrage doesn't tend to motivate voters as consistently or for as long. You think about, for example, the positive emotion around the Obama campaign in 08 and 012 and 2012, it seemed people were responding to positive, upbeat emotions and an upbeat message, whereas this seems to be an example of people responding to a negative emotion. So we were slighted, and now we're mobilizing against the slight. Now, that doesn't mean I think Elizabeth Warren is in any danger politically, because despite the negative emotion of this particular event, she personally is something akin to a Bernie Sanders figure, the populist left-wing mobilizer. So she will still, I think, do just fine and be well-positioned to run in 2020 if that's what she chooses to do.
Now, I find it interesting that you consider that this to be negative emotion, because to me, it's actually ended positive, right? She's actually gotten tons of votes. We have a slogan, but nevertheless, she persisted is something that I think resonates really strongly, not only with women in our careers, but in also the resist movement that's going on right now, right? We're all experiencing some Trump fatigue, at least those of us on the left. And nevertheless, she persisted it just kind of reinvigorated those of us who were passionate at the march but are getting tired now.
Mm-hmm. I don't mean negative emotion in the sense that it doesn't feel empowering to have such a – it's a great slogan. I mean negative in the sense that it is a response to, in this case, what you and I agree was a hypocritical slight against Senator Warren. It's a reaction to a negative event, as opposed to being enticed from the get-go by someone saying, join me for all of these great reasons. It's a response to a negative slight, if that makes any sense.
What I find interesting is that all of you are seeing the negative slight almost more negatively than I am, because I'm looking at it as like, oh, gee, the jackasses have done this again. Right? This, to me, is more of the same. It's not a new negative. This is expected. So it's not a new negative. It's just, oh, great, more of the same. It's like, oh, you know, let's block a judge and then let's complain about it. The concept that the Democrats might do the same thing, right? It's the same, more of the same. It's not a new special negative.
But it's still negative, though.
Well, yeah, but to me, I just expect negative at this point.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Matt, I'm not sure that the negative emotions are that transient in our populace. For one thing, the voters have a memory span that probably doesn't go beyond 4 or 5 weeks unless there's something that keeps it fanned up. So if people keep on fanning this, it'll remain as a factor. The wall in Mexico has remained a factor for over a year now, because every couple days it gets re-raised as an issue, and clearly it's a negative factor. There's nothing positive about building a $15 to $25 billion wall to keep people out or in, whichever the case to be. So I guess where I'm going is I think that negative campaigning has become the way our politicians campaign. There's virtually nothing in this last. My own feeling is that Secretary Clinton lost this election because she decided not to campaign on issues, but instead spent most of her advertising stuff on negative campaigning, and didn't really get out and shake the flesh and say, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to accomplish. She did some of that, but very damn little, frankly.
Well, on the other hand, I was actually going to bring up 2016 as the counterexample to what Matt was saying about in the long term positive works, because you know, Donald Trump's vision and message was relentlessly negative in terms of what he thought the state of things was in the world. Now, obviously, he was saying I could fix it. But if you compared, you know, the Republican convention to the Democratic convention and looked at the messages that they were giving, you know, the Republican convention was very negative about how bad things are and how much we have to fix it, whereas the Democrats were very positive about look at all the potential. And so I don't know if there is a consistent pattern of whether negative or positive works better in politics. I think we've seen incidents of both working in the past, depending on sort of the mood at the moment and which candidates are carrying the banner.
Well, you talked about the positive message put forth by the Democratic Party, especially at their convention, and they did manage to convince more people of their message.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else to say on this topic before we move on?
To the Alex segment.
okay, Alex, go ahead. Give your statement.
Here we go. AlexandTheWeb.com. Bang Alex and Dad. Gaming videos and more from Alex. Elementary school by day. YouTube by night. AlexandTheWeb.com. AlexandTheWeb is AlexandTheWeb. And .com is period and then com.
Let me roll the dice again to see what's next. We will do Trump and foreign policy next. A number of things happened along these lines this week. Let me just run down some of the highlights, and then folks can talk about them. Last week we had leaks of phone calls that Donald Trump had with Australia and Mexico, and those were interesting in their own ways. This week, we had leaks of a call with France that also apparently didn't go that well. We finally had leaks on the call with Vladimir Putin in Russia. Most of these calls have happened a while ago at this point, but we're just getting the leaks now. The interesting part on the Russia call was specifically that Vladimir Putin brought up the New START treaty, and Trump had to sort of pause to ask his advisors what that was. And apparently, from the leaks we've heard so far, no mentions whatsoever in that call of sanctions or the Russian meddling in the election type of stories that were big right before the inauguration. We also had the issue of National Security Advisor Flynn before the inauguration having conversations with the Russian ambassador about those sanctions. Apparently, the sanctions were announced, and then within the next 48 hours, Flynn had a number of conversations with the Russian ambassador. He had previously claimed that those sanctions were not discussed at all. The news this week is that numerous sources have confirmed that the government has him on tape on those conversations talking about sanctions. And specifically reassuring the Russians that don't worry about this. As soon as Trump gets in, we'll take a new look at this, which resulted apparently in Putin not retaliating for those sanctions and diplomatic expulsions and such, but rather saying, never mind, we're not going to worry about this right now. And then finally, along those lines as well, there was the Russia lines. There was confirmation yesterday, again, from a number of sources in investigative positions in the government, that the government has now been able to confirm some of the items in that dossier that was released in early January by BuzzFeed and had been circling around the general public for months before that. Not the general public, but Washington, D.C. and the press and those type of folks. And what they've been able to confirm, they're being very vague about it. They say it's not the scandalous personal stuff, but rather some of the conversations that Russians were having about the influence on the campaign that they've been able to confirm. The things they've been able to directly confirm do not directly implicate either Trump or his staff, but they lend credence to the legitimacy of the document as a whole. And then finally, there have been some flip-flops on China. Donald Trump had famously made that call to the president of Taiwan and questioned the One China policy. There were articles in the New York Times earlier this week and Washington Post, I think, about how basically China was freezing the administration out on all diplomatic fronts until Donald Trump said he would honor the One China policy, which earlier this week he did. And so he finally got a phone call with the president of China, and part of that call was saying, we'll follow One China. Forget what I said before. With you know, and Trump had previously said he wanted to use that as leverage to get some concessions out of the Chinese. There's no indication that anything like that happened. It looks like Trump just folded on that, potentially out of advice from Tillerson and other members of his new cabinet, who basically told him what he was doing was not the right way to go. So that's just a quick rundown of a whole bunch of foreign policy things that happened this week. So anyone want to start off with some thoughts on how this is all going?
Holy moly.
Okay. If nobody's jumping in with something more substantial to start with, I'll pick one of you. Ed, what are your thoughts on how Donald Trump has been handling foreign policy, specifically the things this week?
He's handling it about like I would have expected, frankly. The man has no experience in international relations other than as a businessman. He doesn't understand diplomacy in the remotest stretch of anyone's imagination. And what he understands is threats, cajoling, and then negotiation out of either fear or threats. So, quite frankly, I'm not sure we've heard the last of the One China issue. Right now, he said, oh, yeah, we'll go with One China. I would not make a bet on that lasting 6 months to a year before something else happens, because his history is that of saying something and then later on bringing it back up and doing something different. This morning I was listening to the radio as I was driving over to the hardware store and to this the one policy issue that's on PBS. I can't remember the name of the show. But anyway, they were talking about the fact that Trump, they think he did so well because doesn't have an ideology. My impression is that he doesn't have a Republican ideology, because he differs from the classic Republican ideology in multiple ways. But the man is almost nothing but an ideologue, because he picks up an idea and fixates on it. So we have, according to him, millions of immigrants coming from Mexico and destroying our jobs, despite the fact that the data show that. He finds that we have the highest murder rate in the history of our nation, even though it's at the lowest ebb it's been since we started keeping data. And it doesn't matter. His ideology says murder is a real risk and danger, and therefore it is real. And that's how he handles foreign relations, too. He's like a bull in a china shop.
Sometimes I wonder all of these lies and these flip. For the record, by the way, I'm not a Trump supporter. I've been against him since he started that whole birther nonsense. But I think part of this might be his attempt at some kind of exercise in loyalty among his supporters. Because it seems that's one thing he truly values, is who is going to blindly follow him no matter how many times he turns, no matter how many mistakes he makes. And so in cases like this, he's trying to fetter out people who aren't going to agree no matter what.
Well, I think you're right. His history is of terminating people who disagree with him.
Right, regardless of qualification. You know, there's the issue, I suppose we'll get in later, with, say, Betsy DeVos and her nomination to be Secretary of Education, in addition to having, of course, contributed an enormous amount to various Republican causes and the Trump campaign. I don't know about her personally, but I would imagine the one thing that would draw Donald Trump to her, something he looks for, is she going to be a yes woman, someone who just does what he says? And as far as foreign policy goes, I think up until he entered politics, or whatever you want to call it nowadays, Donald Trump was, in a way, the big fish in the room. He had, in addition to his wealth and his business enterprises, the Trump brand and his charisma. But now when he's dealing with foreign countries, for example, the Chinese, they're a big fish too. And people in China probably don't care nearly as much about Donald Trump's brand as people might in the United States, who've been familiar with him for decades. He is out of his element.
Yeah, I think you definitely have that. And in terms of ideological stuff, one of the things that has been pointed out by foreign policy people occasionally is that while he's been all over the map on all sorts of other issues, in foreign policy, he's actually been rather consistent going back decades in his sort of America first neo-isolationist type of position where, you know, America shouldn't be involved overseas in all of these things. We should be pulling back and favoring sort of unilateral one-on-one engagements over anything multilateral, saying that, you know, international institutions are generally speaking bad. We can make a deal with Mexico. We can make a deal with the UK, but we shouldn't be in NAFTA. We shouldn't have, you know, an agreement with all of Europe, etc. And he's been fairly consistent on a lot of this foreign policy stuff. But what you find consistently as well is that, and this goes across the board, it seems, to almost anything Trump is involved in, is the last thing anyone would ever say about Trump is that he's a detail person. He is about the very, very high level concepts. He has no clue of the details, of the nuance, of what's actually going on under the covers. So you get things like him being on the call with Russia and them bringing up, you know, one of the major agreements that was signed between the U.S. and Russia in the last decade, and he has no idea what it is. He asks his aides, hears like a 2-second summary, and then makes a decision that he thinks it was bad. It was a bad deal, you know, and therefore he railed against it for a few minutes on that call. Whereas from the little I've read about it, I'm not an expert in these things either. The deal was actually fairly beneficial to the U.S. and fairly restrictive on Russia. And so it's like, what are you even talking about? So I think that's a theme on almost everything. I think, you know, I think it was Ed who said he was a bull in the China shop. And I think that's exactly what you have, certainly in foreign policy, in most other issues as well. It's just that he's the kind of person who, and you know, if you deal with one of these people in your own work, you realize how difficult it is to deal with them. But the kind of person who jumps into something without knowing the full picture of what's going on, has a very high level idea of where they want to go, and just tries to shove it forward with all their might past anybody who's trying to say, well, okay, but let's consider these factors that might also be important, because none of that matters. It's just run full steam ahead. And I think that's what you have with Trump, and especially in the foreign policy realm. Like domestic policy, you've got to deal with the Congress. You know, as we're seeing with the Mexico stuff, and we'll talk about in the next segment, you've got to deal with the courts. You know, you've got a lot of limitations on presidential power. With flat-out foreign policy, the president has a lot of latitude. They can do almost anything without too much interference from the other branches of government. Trump is finding out he's getting a little bit of backlash from his own bureaucracy. But there's a lot of damage Trump can do on his own just with a phone call. I mean, as we saw in the last couple weeks, you know, he gets on the phone with the leaders of, you know, Australia, Mexico, France, and within the space of an hour on the phone, he's caused tension in those relationships that was much less before. You know, Mexico has been building for a while because of Trump, but Australia, there was nothing going on in the U.S.-Australia relationship worth noting. And all of a sudden, it's a big deal. And I don't know.
So my question is, where is this going to take us, right? We're 3 weeks into a bull in a China shop administration. Are we just going to continuously look like idiots, which I feel like is the best case scenario? Or are we going to get into some real trouble, whether it's economically or, God forbid, a war as a result of this ham-fistedness?
I think the thing that concerns me the most is that when you deal in international relations in this kind of a gut decision, off-the-cuff type manner, the risks of war are very, very real. And, you know, there's to Trump, his concept of military is that he went to a military school and that trained him how to be a soldier. He didn't need to be a soldier, and hasn't been a soldier. He's probably never seen a dead person, certainly has never seen someone who was a few feet away from a bomb that went off. He's never gone through the experiences of the devastation that comes from pissing off an enemy enough that they declare war in you. It's a game to him. It's a game to an awful lot of our politicians. They're not the guys that go in the battlefield and try and put people back together who get hit by those damn bombs.
So I heard you two say two things. One is that Trump is the poster child for the Dunning-Kruger effect, where they assume their ability is much higher than it really is because they know a little, so they extrapolate that to a lot. And the other is a disregard for human life. Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm not even sure it's so much a disregard for human life as it is he doesn't care what happens when he says something. You know, if he cared a lot, Mexico and China are two of our three biggest trading partners. The way you keep peaceful relations is by trading with people and exchanging, negotiating new deals and this kind of stuff. It's really hard to declare war on someone who sells you a loaf of bread. You just don't go down to the grocery store and hit the grocer in the nose because he said something you didn't like. And yet, that's what's going on. The Mexico economy, since NAFTA, as I understand it, has really turned a corner. And there's a reason why there are not many Mexicans coming to the United States these days. It's because they can get jobs down there now selling stuff to us. So we have a choice. We could say, well, we're going to cut off all imports from Mexico. Mexico will go broke. The number of people escaping up here to try and find food and employment will increase again. I suspect that would cost a lot more than our negative trade balance with Mexico, somewhere in the range of 10 to 20 billion, isn't it, a year? It's a relatively small amount, I know.
I don't know the number. I'll take your word for it. We can look it up.
Yeah, it's less than 50 billion, as I recall, which is, that sounds like a lot of money to me, but it's in the overall scheme of things, it's just not that much when you look at what we get from it.
So I'll add one additional thing. In terms of the things that you mentioned about Trump and the risk of war, the other I'd add is what is becoming clear is the administration's, let's put it as, lack of respect for the concept of truth. In that, there's a constant sort of pushback on, well, what can be objectively determined? And, everything from inauguration size to other little details that have come up. But where that comes in the case of war and peace situations, is you can easily see, some event happening somewhere and us having very limited information on what's really going on here. Trump making a rash decision based on rumor or innuendo or the explanation that Breitbart has at the moment of what's going on without waiting or caring to know, well, what's really going on? What's the truth of this situation? And those kinds of situations can very easily blow up and that it's concerning every time you hear one of these things where it seems like the Trump administration is denying clearly objective fact and trying to make people not be able to judge, well, who's right and who's wrong? Is Trump telling the truth or is the New York Times telling the truth, et cetera? And, there's certainly many items that are, matters of political opinion. But there really are things where you can know the answer. I mean, you brought up a few minutes ago murder rates and such, and where, yes, there was a very slight uptick in the last measured year, but the overall trend has been significantly down for decades. And you spin that number wrong or, as Trump did, just directly misstate it. And you create a completely different impression of the world. And if you have large number of people just believing it, you can move into a situation where you rapidly descend into something that's going to escalate into a war or something like that. Now, I don't know, the worst case scenario fears are always Trump either intentionally or by accident bumbling ourselves into a very avoidable war. And I hope we don't actually get to that point, but I certainly see us in a situation of having completely unneeded levels of tension with countries around the world. I think we're already seeing that in the first 3 weeks, and I don't know if Trump is going to learn and decide, you know, maybe it would be better if I take a slightly different approach here. I think his history shows that he doesn't, he's not going to change. But
hey, maybe I could not be a jackass. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
That's happening.
Yeah, it's...
he takes everything very, very personally, which is, it's so dangerous. Because when he attaches himself to an idea, it's not, the discussion isn't about the idea itself anymore. It's about him personally. And so he'll fight tooth and nail to defend it, because you're attacking not just the idea, but him. And when it comes to foreign policy or stumbling into a war, that Sam, that hypothetical scenario you talked about, it also all goes back to Donald Trump's desire to portray himself as the alpha male in the room. And so regardless of the facts we have or how little we have, he's going to try and go as far toward the machismo as he can, try to make America seem as the strong, the person, the nation that's going to be taking charge immediately, no questions asked.
And this is one of the areas, too, where I think it's important to point out the differences between Donald Trump and, say, any of the other Republicans that were running against them. There are certainly other Republicans who are hawks. There are certainly other Republicans who also feel that we should be more aggressive in our foreign policy. But that's, and some of that, I mean, I feel is dangerous too, but I think Donald Trump takes it to a whole level, another level, because he combines that aggressive machismo type of attitude with the, I don't care about the details, I don't want to think this through, I just want to act. Whereas I think you pick any of the other Republicans who are running, even many that I would disagree with on almost everything, including foreign policy issues, and they wouldn't have that same level of rashness and ability to sort of jump into something without understanding what's going on. I would at least think, you know, as a random example, let's take Mike Pence. I at least think Mike Pence would think through things before responding. Now, before we move on, Matt, you've been rather quiet the last few minutes. Anything you want to add to this discussion?
No, the big point I wanted to get out came out, that Donald Trump internalizes things a lot. And now that he is, you know, the presidency is essentially the face of the United States, now any slight against the United States, however small, even if it's, say, a crude gesture from a foreign military ship to our sailors on another, is now not just an insult against the United States, but an insult against him personally. And because of that, in combination with his rashness, it is. It's going to get us into a lot of terrible situations.
Yeah. As numerous people have pointed out, just wait until someone does an attack on a Trump property in some random country. And how will Donald respond there? Yeah. Whereas it might be something that you would, okay, there's an attack. You want to figure out the appropriate reaction no matter what, but he would take that as a direct attack on him.
Mm-hmm. And his brand, which is that he's admitted openly, his image, his brand, those are his biggest assets, his greatest commodities. And anytime you impugn them, you're now imputing the United States and vice versa.
Right.
So that terrifies me.
All the more avenues for him to get us into trouble.
You know, Sam, you commented about the dangers maybe not being great of stumbling into a war. As I look back over the last several wars our nation's fought in, I think almost all of them we stumbled into, beginning with Vietnam. And that's what scares me, is that the devastation of war to human beings is beyond the imagination of most of us.
And this is something that, you know, as the years have moved on, you know, has become more of a factor, I think, because a smaller in the more recent wars, a smaller and smaller portion of the population has been directly affected by those wars. because we don't have the draft anymore. Not that I'm advocating for one, but we don't have the draft anymore. The people who are going to war typically are from very specific social strata that go there. And the vast majority of people, you know, if you're talking about, well, who has been involved in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and who has been involved, in the previous Iraq war, you know, the number of people who directly have friends or family members who were even there, let alone injured or killed, is much, much smaller than it was in the Vietnam War era, let alone World War II. And so most people don't have a direct experience of war as something that is personally affecting to them. Because we haven't had a war on our home soil, and the number of people involved has been smaller and smaller. So, yeah, I think you're right that most people are like, I mean, we've been at war in Afghanistan for, what, 12 years now? More? I forget. I guess more.
15.
And most people at this point are like, what? We don't even notice.
It's par for the course now. Especially with young people who were maybe 4 or 5 years old when September 11th happened. Their entire lives have, this war has been going on, and also for nearly as long in Iraq.
Yeah.
That's depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't have that many casualties. Now, we keep talking about them, but frankly, we have very few casualties. But the Afghanis have casualties in the millions now, probably, or at least the hundreds of thousands.
Yep.
And as is typical of virtually every war that's ever been fought, the majority of those casualties are civilians. They are not warriors. They are not participants in the war. But the war takes place on grounds in cities and farmland. And the people who live in those cities and farmlands are the ones that get killed or starved or die of disease.
And Trump has signaled over and over that he is dumbfounded why we don't use our military more to solve problems than we do. And specifically, the one thing that came out several times over the course of the last few months is he's asked, when he's been getting briefings on situation A, B, or C around the world, he's repeatedly asked his military advisors, why don't we use nukes? You know, and
there was in Colin Powell's autobiography, he has a great moment when he was briefing the cabinet on some sort of a potential area where we might go in with combat troops. And the Powell principle was that you don't go in unless you have overwhelming strength and can devastate the enemy in a hurry, thereby having the fewest casualties in both your forces and, frankly, theirs, because the battle's over in a hurry. And he said, whatever it was in this particular one, he said, I don't think we have that kind of strength that we can end this particular battle in a hurry. And one of the other cabinet members said to him something that just blew me away, which was along the lines of, well, General Powell, why do we have these great soldiers that you keep bragging about if we never use them?
Yeah. So,
and that, I'm afraid, is the attitude of a lot of civilians who say, well, let's send some soldiers in.
It's one of the symptoms, too, I think, of having fewer and fewer veterans in Congress.
Could be.
People who don't understand.
You know, there's only one man in Congress who raises hell every time they talk about torture, and that's the man who was tortured.
John McCain.
Right. It's one of the symptoms. You have more limited conflicts, which have fewer U.S. soldiers involved, and so that produces fewer veterans who, when they get older, would potentially run for Congress.
Therefore,
no empathy.
Having said that, I don't think the solution to that is more and bigger wars.
No, of course.
But
absolutely not.
Fewer and smaller wars. Let's quit looking to shoot each other.
So, yeah, on that note, as I said, that I think, I don't know whether Trump would seriously ever consider nukes, but the fact that he even asks about it regularly is worrying, and that's been leaked. I just want to give a quick plug. I'm currently listening to the latest episode of the Hardcore History podcast, which is really sort of a mini audiobook. It's like this episode is 6 hours long.
Holy moly.
But it's about sort of the history of nuclear weaponry and how people have decided to interact with them, and the initial use at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also how the evolution of how we've thought about nuclear weapons has gone over the course of the Cold War and beyond. I'm only about halfway through it, but it's very good. I would point it out to people who are interested in such things, because I keep listening to it. And for instance, I recently finished the part where they were talking about Harry Truman and Eisenhower and how they both sort of decided not to use nuclear weapons in Korea and various situations in that immediate time period, where many of their military advisors were recommending that they do. And I keep thinking to myself, how would Trump react in that circumstance? And I'm not happy with my thoughts there.
With good reason.
So anyway, let's take another break. And we'll be back. Let me roll the dice here to see which of the two remaining topics go next. And Donald Trump and the judiciary. We'll do that next, and then we'll end up the show with the tone of political conversation and such. Back after this.
Facebook, Facebook, Facebook!
Hey, do you want to help support Curmudgeon's Corner? Well, right now, the best way is through Facebook. If you haven't already liked us on Facebook and you actually, like us, then go search for Curmudgeon's Corner on Facebook and like our page. It will help you see when we announce new episodes, and it'll help us reach more new people too. If you like a particular episode, like our episode announcement post too, or share it with your friends. All of this helps spread the word about our podcast to more people who might like it as well. And of course, we love having a conversation with all of you listeners, so please use Facebook to leave comments on the shows, give us suggestions, or anything else like that. It's always great to hear from you. So, if you want to help the show, use Facebook. Or forget all of that and just send us money. Okay, we are back, and it is time for Donald Trump and the judiciary. And just as a heads up, a couple of folks on the call may have to drop off after this. So, you know, depending how it goes, we may just miss the last segment, or we may stay on and talk about that a little bit after folks leave. We'll see how it goes. But Donald Trump and the judiciary. And Matt, this was your topic, and obviously this was prompted by the legal cases going on around the executive order on immigration. But why don't you give a little bit of background, and then we'll go from there.
I suppose the background is that there was an executive order by which Donald Trump sought to, I believe temporarily, I think for however long, ban refugees from coming into the United States from a select list of predominantly Muslim countries. And then on top of that, created a small exception for Christian refugees within those countries. Now, this was challenged by Washington State. In part, they believed they had been harmed because certain people who were working within their university system who were immigrants from those countries had been kept out. And it went up through to the Ninth Circuit. And after having lost on appeal, naturally, Donald Trump's reaction was a see you in court on yet another Twitter rampage. And yet now, despite having sworn that he would see the state of Washington in court, in the Supreme Court, he has said he's going to implement a different plan, something that I imagine he thinks will survive judicial scrutiny for now.
And that actually is still somewhat unclear. I mean, Trump and members of his administration have been giving contradictory messages over the last 24 hours on their plans. Mm-hmm. And as best I can tell, based on Trump's own most recent statements, they're basically in an all options are still open mode, and they have not made a decision. But they are considering appealing to the Supreme Court over the latest ruling about not lifting the TRO, temporary restraining order. They are considering issuing a new executive order that would be better on the various aspects that have been called out. They are considering going through to the process of continuing to discuss the case on its merits, et cetera, and basically just are still throwing everything open. As you said, at various points over the last 24 hours, various administration officials had said, actually, this is what we're going to do. But then usually within an hour or two, somebody else has said, no, actually, we're still making up our minds. So it's really unclear to me what they're actually going to do.
What gets me is the basis for this travel ban, and the same basis that had been used by previous administrations who had done certain similar things, though not nearly as poorly as Donald Trump has implemented it, is that they're typically based on a specific credible threat, something that is about to happen or is likely to happen. So if that's the case, I assume Donald Trump has access to more intelligence briefings than I do. Whether he pays attention is his own issue. But if that's the case, then surely he wouldn't be wanting to ride out this entire appeals process. He should be at least putting forth some new executive order, something that, based on what the Ninth Circuit has said and what the Supreme Court would be likely to say, that he believes would survive judicial scrutiny so that he can do the best he can to protect the American citizens from what ought to be a specific credible threat.
And one of the things the court actually pointed out is that they've declined to give any reasons. You know, they've said, well, show us the evidence of any threat. And, you know, you can say, of course, you don't want to have that information public. The courts have mechanisms to look at classified information in a confidential context when it's appropriate. They haven't been taking advantage of any of that. So they've basically stated, well, at one point, they stated, look, there's an imminent threat we have to deal with. And then later, when Sean Spicer was asked about it in one of his press conferences, he actually backed off on that and said, no, there's nothing imminent and specific. It's just the generalized threat.
It's security. It's just security. It's security. Oh, sorry.
But you know,
I was trying to channel Yvonne for a moment, but I think I failed.
You missed a couple words that Yvonne would have used.
I know. I'm trying to stop those.
One thing I did find, if there's any positive in this, when the orders first started coming in right after the ban took effect and there was all this chaos, there were lots of reports of people on the ground ignoring the judicial orders. And since the fuller restraining order came out, the Trump administration has actually said, we're going to respect this order and fight it in court, which for a while it seemed like that was actually a question.
Which scared the crap out of me, because that was like, hey, watch our checks and balances fail.
Right. And one of the things about the Trump administration is it seems like you can't take that for granted, because I keep expecting if Trump loses and loses and loses again in court, at some point, does he just say, OK, screw it, make him stop me? I don't know. And he hasn't this time, which I think is great. But all of this, again, going back to sort of being ham-fisted and a bull in a china shop, if they had been more careful about this executive order in the first place, I think I mentioned on a last week's show or maybe the one before, if they had simply excluded green card holders from the beginning and said this takes effect in 2 weeks and we're only going to stop accepting new applications, but if you've already got a visa, it will be honored, then frankly, this would not have made the splash that it did. I mean, right. it may have still had a lot of negative impact on a lot of innocent people who aren't really terrorists and would benefit from coming to the United States, and we would benefit from them. But frankly, if it had been done that way, the outrage would have been much more muted. It would have been some group specifically of immigration advocates trying to make a case, and it wouldn't have gotten the same level of public resonance. You got the reaction you did. because you got pictures of the kids separated from their parents, and you got stories of the 6 month old who was trying to get to the United States for emergency heart surgery, and you got all of these cases that you heard about, and so people were outraged by it, and people were having protests at the airport because people were being held at those airports. If he'd done it with any modicum of thought, he could have avoided all of this, which again brings up the question we talked a little bit about before, a little while ago, about is this just them being idiots, or are they actually wanting to antagonize these people as part of their strategy?
I think, Sam, that it really is more likely a complete lack of knowledge of, the word political correctness comes to mind. The politically correct way to issue an executive order is that you write out what you think you want said or done. Then you staff that with various people who would be affected. But, and that would include congressional in this case, the congressional committees that deal with foreign relations and terrorism and so on and so forth. You staff it. Those people send back their suggestions. You rewrite it, send it out again. It takes weeks to get done. My job when I was in the Pentagon was writing the Department of Defense directives for the healthcare. And it took 6 to 10 months to get something done that I could have written off in 5 minutes. But an executive order needs to go faster than 6 to 9 months. But you do have to get input from people who are affected. The police, the military, the Secretary of State, and all these sorts of things. You don't just sit down and write off and say, hey, this is what I'm going to do.
And that's exactly what all the reports say happened here, is basically a small group that may have been as small as like five people sat down and wrote this without talking to anybody else.
Now, didn't they say they consulted one lawyer?
Yeah, they say they ran it past the office that is supposed to review such things. But it's actually unclear from the timeline if they did that before or after it was actually signed, and whether or not there was a full review actually done, or whether they just got a rubber stamp.
My was written by Steve Bannon, and if it was staffed at all, it was staffed with people afraid of Steve Bannon.
Yeah, and so, and there were so many random errors here. There was another executive order, not this one we're talking about, but one relating to people serving as lobbyists after they leave government and such that Trump signed, that was just pointed out by ProPublica yesterday, that they went through the order and actually found that it references laws that don't exist. Now it was just a typo, apparently. It was section 18 instead of 28 or something of some law. But that's the kind of thing where,
But you see, if
they're
you
not
staff,
checking.
If you staff these things correctly, typos get picked up.
And speaking of typos, there was that list of terrorist incidents where for half the document they spelled attacker incorrectly.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, this is just the general theme of doing things in a half-ass way without people checking their work and without bothering to think through the ramifications seems to occur time and time again. Now, I want to get back real quick specifically to Trump and the judiciary, because that was the topic here. So Matt, being our lawyer on the panel, what do you think of the proceedings that have happened so far and where they're likely to go next? I mean, so far, none of the courts have actually ruled on the merits. It's been right. That's yet to come. Do you think, given the existing order, if this did go all the way to the merits and get appealed through its, does Trump, what does it look like? I mean, so far, it's been almost unanimous rulings against Trump. I think there was one court in Massachusetts that ruled in his favor. But for the most part, it's gone against Trump, against Trump, against Trump. Is that something that would continue, or do you think that he has a shot when it actually gets to the merits?
I don't think he has a shot when it gets to the merits, I'll be honest. When it comes to our government stepping in on certain fundamental rights, things like, say, where the government would discriminate based on national origin. You have to provide, it is an enormous hurdle that the government has to get over for something that is that kind of discriminatory. And for that to happen, you have to provide specific, concrete, absolutely necessary reasons why this is done. And if you can, I mean, granted, I am new at this, but if you can articulate those specific reasons, then you might get a pass. But because it doesn't appear that the government has any, then I don't see how the executive order could possibly stand.
Do you think they could? Well, two questions. Let me go in order. The way the administration has been interacting with these lawsuits, I mean, we've got the firing of the acting attorney general the other week. We've got, frankly, the lawyer who was arguing this case seemed to come in with arguments that were relatively weak. And it seems like I heard a number of people commenting that they didn't seem as prepared as they could be for some of these things. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you've got Donald Trump himself tweeting out essentially insults against the judiciary. What do you think of how the administration's handling all this?
Poorly. Nothing's going to bring the judiciary onto Donald Trump's side quite like insulting them. It works wonders on me when people do it to me.
Yeah.
It's a consequence. The lack of preparedness is a consequence of this law having been written in a closed room by a handful of people who were prized, I think, more for their loyalty than their expertise. And on top of that, the executive order was put through so quickly, just as a spur of the moment kind of thing, that no one had time to prepare to defend it. Now, even so, if it were to be addressed on the merits, I still don't think it would stand up to a judiciary who's been called out and insulted for 2 weeks by Donald Trump, and also given the flaws of the executive order itself.
Yeah, I mean, basically telling them, hey, you shouldn't even be looking at this isn't necessarily the winning argument.
No, and what in a little bit of defense of Trump in this, this sort of approach to the judiciary has been carried out by both parties for a long time. There's that age-old refrain that we've heard how many times of non-elected judges. Of course judges aren't elected. Our Constitution was set up with that very specifically in mind. Hamilton spent several of the Federalist papers talking about why judges should not be elected and should be appointed for life in order to safeguard us and be a balance against threats.
Yeah. Okay, and any last thoughts on this before we move on? I'll take that as a no. Matt, did you say you had to leave us at this point?
Not anymore.
Oh, not anymore. Okay. Well,
and I had it taken care of, so we're good.
And I think Jen has another 15 minutes or so. So
let's I got 20 more minutes.
So okay.
Yeah.
So let's take another break, and then we will come back. That should be just about enough to finish up the show. So we'll be back right after this, talking about the tone of political dialogue these days. Back after this.
Information.
Okay, we're back. So, Ed, this is your topic, so why don't you introduce it?
Okay, well, my concern is in all kinds of dialogue and debate and arguments in recent, maybe more than recent years, the temptation on the part of so many people is to not bother arguing the issues, but instead to rejoin to insults and ad hominem attacks and vitriol. And the problem I have with this is that as I look at it, it strikes me that really these attacks are another form of violence, not in, in that there's no striking, but it's a verbal violence that leads on to a potential for escalation. If you look at violence as a spectrum, at one end you have me calling someone ugly, at the other end you have dropping an atomic bomb. But that's a spectrum, and all of those are evidence of some degree of violence. I don't know that I ever thought of it that way until in reading James Farmer's autobiography. He talks about going in and meeting with the Friends, the Quakers, and trying to get them to sponsor and help finance some of his activities. And after a long debate, they came out and said, well, we support everything you're doing, except that we don't like your methodology. And he said, what do you mean? They said, well, we do not believe in violence, will not practice violence, and you're using lawsuits and suing. And as far as we're concerned, suing is a form of violence. And so while they supported him in his efforts to get through civil rights, they opposed his use of what they perceived as violence. And I think it's time that we start approaching people who throw insults, most of which are our politicians, so readily and so easily, and say to them, if you're too ignorant, now there I go doing the same thing, if you can't to look up some data and policy and argue this without recourse to insults, then I'm not going to waste my time talking to you because I can't deal with that, don't want to deal with it, won't deal with it, if you will.
I think if you took out the people who use personal attacks off of cable news, you'd have a blank screen.
I think America.
And that's a bad thing.
A little less.
No, TV. Not necessarily.
You know, it just keeps coming back again. You know, the thing that occurred during the Elizabeth Warren that we talked about earlier, shortly after she was quieted, a fellow by the name of Senator Rubio got up and gave a 5-minute speech in which he talked about the importance of maintaining decorum in the Senate and treating each other with respect and not insulting each other. And as I heard about that, I recalled Senator Rubio in the debates talking about someone's small hands. And he didn't argue with Trump about policies that Trump was expounding, which easily could have been argued with. He talks about his small hands. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, Rubio, people sort of describe that as a suicide mission because he hadn't been doing that before. He did it in one debate. He specifically changed tactics and was really one of the first people to get some hits on Donald Trump that seemed to bother him. I mean, it was a tactic.
His other tactic at the same time was to talk about President Obama and the sentence that he repeated something like 5 or 10 times during the debate. Don't ever think he doesn't know exactly what he's doing. Come on, let's talk about policies.
And the thing you get, first of all, I don't disagree in principle. But what you see time and time again is that when people do start talking policy, almost everybody tunes out. But when you get you know, sort of the fireworks of two personalities going at it, everybody tunes in and pays attention. I mean, you just look at our conversation earlier. Like you said, we were talking about the incident with Elizabeth Warren on the floor of the Senate. We did not go into discussions of the pros and cons and merits of Sessions as Attorney General.
That's another whole hour.
But, you know, I come to think of this myself in terms of, you know, how polarized this election was and how the Trump camp and the Clinton camp and I'd say even the Sanders camp really sort of isolated themselves from each other to a large degree. And I think it's still true. I mean, if you listen to, I think it was on last week's show where Yvonne and I were talking about whether or not anybody was being convinced, anybody who was a Trump supporter was moving over and thinking, oh, maybe I made a mistake. And how polls weren't showing much movement yet. You hear lots of anecdotal things, but polls weren't showing much movement. And Yvonne basically saying, I don't care. I don't give a crap about those people. I've given up on them. They, you know, I only care about energizing and activating the liberals to act against this. But I don't care about converting people, because if you voted for Donald Trump, you're lost, essentially.
I think we're seeing a few different things. So one is that whole, like, you know, fights on the elementary school playground draw a crowd. Mm-hmm. Right. It's human nature to like the salacious stuff, to like the conflict. But we're also seeing a lot of people who are panicked or hurting, or they have their emotions massively engaged. And at that point, you don't become a nice person. And I know, like I mentioned my liberal bubble before, and I've noticed, you know, aren't they idiots? Aren't they this? Aren't they that? Here's this video. Here's that video. And about half of them, I'm like, you know, this is a normal human thing to do. I'm not going to assume that they're really stupid just because what they made a single mistake. Now, patterns of mistakes that I'm seeing, well, okay, stupid. But see, there I go. But overall, you've got a lot of people who are panicked and hurting. And so we're seeing much more hurtful language and actions.
And so I don't know. I mean, in terms of that, you do get into the situation where people really are thinking about it as, here's my team and here's the enemy. And I really don't care what the enemy has to say. And I think, you know, one, you know, Donald Trump actually did show with this election that you can win elections by playing to your base and not caring at all about converting the other side. And we know from turnout information that something like 45% of eligible voters did not vote. So you've got a huge pool there that you potentially could turn the results of elections back and forth simply by engaging people who didn't vote. And not worrying about converting the people who already have picked a side and are voting. But it seems really unhealthy to be in a state where essentially both sides are saying, we don't care about converting the other side. We don't care about convincing them that we're right, because they're evil. They're wrong. And I think that's where we are for a lot of people right now.
Yep. I think that would be a huge mistake, though, for Democrats right now, because from the Republicans I do know in Chicago and my extended network of Republicans that I talk to on a regular basis, there are two kinds of people who voted for Donald Trump. There are those who were really gung-ho about it from day one, and then there are those who maybe reluctantly did it, as they weren't happy about it and maybe did it just to, say, protect the Supreme Court and make sure there was a Republican or a conservative nominee.
Just for background, if I remember correctly, you were on our show where I did an interview with Republicans and we did a quick update of that right before Election Day. You mm-hmm. are a Republican, but you ended up as a Gary Johnson voter, correct?
Right.
Okay. Continue.
So there are an enormous number of reluctant people who reluctantly voted for Donald Trump, who, I mean, we're 2 weeks into his administration now, and it's been crises and mistakes on a daily basis. I think those people would be very amenable to supporting a good Democratic candidate come 2020. And it's a mistake to write off that many people, that many potential voters.
I think you're generally right that writing off these reluctant Trump voters is probably a mistake. Specifically, I mean, they've shown there was a huge number of people who were Obama voters and became mm-hmm. Trump voters. Those you could clearly get back. But if everything is sort of couched on, hey, you must be a racist because you voted for Trump, we don't care about you anymore, you almost immediately lose all those people.
It's really hard to be magnanimous, though. When you're terrified. When, you know, I'm sitting over here going, like, how much more anti-Semitic stuff do I have to listen to? You know, when I lost branches of my family tree in the Holocaust, right? How much more of anti-women do I have to get through? I, you know, where can I actually go in my career? How long, you know, I get panicked very easily. So at that point, I could give a rip whether I'm pulling anybody over. I'm fighting for survival, at least emotionally.
And I think you have a lot of people in that position.
I think we need to remember that one of the ways you dominate people is through fear. As long as you keep them afraid of the other or the alien or whatever, you can really dominate pretty thoroughly. The other main technique to dominate is that of guilt. It's guilty people don't object. If I feel like I'm guilty of something, then I won't raise hell about the politicians and what they're doing to us. And the combination of fear and guilt is how we get dominated. And we can't allow ourselves to become afraid of these things. We need to get out and say, this is wrong. You can't do that to people. And by God, we're going to change it.
And I think there are a couple bits here, too. One is definitely that, you know, for one of the tactics at play here is specifically doing that division. It's making it so that every time, you know, so Trump can go to his supporters and say, look at all those people out there protesting at the airports. They want the scary Muslims to come in and kill you. You know, and that drives people in a certain direction. The other is that as weak as it's appeared to be so far, I actually think we should be really encouraging the quote unquote reasonable Republicans, who unfortunately the elected Republicans have fallen in lockstep with Donald Trump for the most part, or have shown almost no willingness to oppose on anything. And the thing you hear time and time again is, okay, he may be somewhat nuts and crazy on these things, but we're willing to ignore that as long as he does what we want on taxes, abortion, immigration, name your particular issues of choice. And it seems like you've got this very, very small group of sort of conservatives like McMullen and some other folks who are keeping the conservative flag up, but clearly opposed to Donald Trump. But that group is incredibly tiny. But it seems like there should be a group. I mean, you hear glimmers of it from McCain and Graham and some other folks who recognize that this guy is nuts and in the right circumstances might do something different. And I don't know. I mean, even if we're talking for 2020, you know, do we have a reasonable Republican challenge in the primaries to Trump? Or no, or, you know, I don't know. It's just, you're right. It is very hard to be magnanimous, and there certainly are a lot of people out there who really do deserve the term deplorable, based on what they're saying and doing. But I think there are a lot of other people out there who are, you know, I keep thinking back to the statement that says, okay, even if you're not a racist, you showed that racism and sexism, et cetera, is not a disqualifier for you. And that says a lot. But at the same time, there are convincible people on the edges. Just by seeing how much polls move back and forth in the weeks right before the election, we know there are convincible people out there. We know there are people who would have voted for any other Democrat other than Hillary Clinton. And so I think the general approach, you know, I shouldn't say approach. I understand the reactions. It's just like, it's very understandable to retreat into us and them, but I think in the end it's counterproductive.
Yep.
Reminds me of Michelle Obama's quote back at the convention, when they go low, we go high. Mm-hmm. That is, granted, not being a Democrat, I still put an enormous amount of value in that statement, and I would hope that that kind of sentiment continues to grow in our politics. We need more of that.
Although some people argue that going high was an error, right? When
maybe going high at the last minute.
Well, yeah. So.
Well, there's some dispute about whether or not how high we really went, because as we were talking a little bit earlier, a lot of the campaign was about how Trump wasn't qualified. Trump was dangerous. Trump was and that's not necessarily going high. I mean, the convention certainly had a whole bunch of high points and was very positive and things like that. But, you know, there was a concentration on Donald Trump's unacceptability. And there have been a number of people who've pointed out that basically a lot of people reacted to that with, how dare you tell me, you know, who I shouldn't vote for. So therefore, I'm going to.
that happened a lot. I know a lot of people who are far more conservative than I do, people who enthusiastically voted for Donald Trump. And one thing I constantly kept seeing them post, and I'm not saying this is correct, but this is how it came off to a lot of people that I've spoken with. It was essentially, tell me why I should vote for Clinton without mentioning Donald Trump.
Right.
Now, that's not to say, of course, that Hillary Clinton didn't have a long and accomplished resume, but that the relentless focus on don't vote for Donald Trump rather than you should vote for Hillary Clinton, that turned off a lot of people and gave people who might have been on the edge about voting Donald Trump something to lean on.
That's interesting, because I saw in my liberal bubble, I saw the opposite meme. Tell me why you're voting for Donald Trump without mentioning Clinton's emails.
Not the least bit surprised.
Yeah, I definitely saw that as well. I mean, I heard both.
Hey guys, I've got to jump off. This has been fun.
I was going to say goodbye anyway, so I just want to thank everybody for joining us. I think this is a good time to wrap up. If anything, hey, we had a civil conversation, so great.
There you go. You did it.
Go us.
There's hope for America.
So thank you, Ed. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Jen, for joining us at really the last minute. I only sent out the invite a few hours before we're recording, so I really appreciate it. As usual, everybody, comment on the show on our Facebook page. Share it with your friends. If you feel like it, go to Patreon and support us. And tell your friends. We love to have you out there. And we'll see you all next week. And for the guests, again, thank you very much. And we appreciate it and hope to have you again someday.
Thank you.
Okay, goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.